So let me get to this. We've got a subject today, Daniel, that is, it's pretty thick stuff. But we've been doing this series on Daniel. It's taken me almost a year and a half to get to this chapter. It's the 9th in the series in Daniel, but it's not the 9th chapter or the 10th. Now, in college, I took a lot of math. I took advanced calculus. I took differential equations. And maybe you're impressed. Because it didn't take, because obviously I got a phone call or an email from Mr. Nick Marinos, who's the gentleman who puts our videos up, and he said, hey, Daniel 8, I see 7 and I see 9, where's Daniel 8? And I said, uh-oh, I said, I read it, there's a goat in it, a floating goat, a ram, it ends very interestingly, and I guess I just went to 9. So I have to admit my mess up, so I apologize. I obviously can't count, so the math didn't take. This chapter 8 is a strange one. It is relatively short, but it has some incredibly fascinating topics. In fact, it is so critical that it forms the major basis of theology of a major denomination. Chapter 7, that we finished 2 sessions ago, was written in Aramaic. Here Daniel returns back to Hebrew. And something for a very good reason. So we are going to talk about the ram, the he-goat, the 2300, the temple, the sacrifices, and some very interesting conclusions I think you'll find. So folks with their charts and their prophecies that are not quite accurate, they drool over this chapter. They really do. The research I did on this was wide and far and was very, very inaccurate. So as it is in 9, this chapter in 8 spans both years and some centuries. So the SPS, the specific purpose statement, is very simple. We live in a type of Babylon, as did Daniel. And today we're going to explore this critical chapter of Daniel's book with the issue of prophecy, one of the most exact, in fact, of prophecy of the entire Bible. Then we'll analyze it, and then hopefully we have an interesting conclusion about prophetic events. What have I entitled it? Daniel 8, 2300 days, a floating goat, and the king's business. So let's begin and get to it, because we've got a lot to unpack. In chapter 8 and verse 1, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me. To me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. Now, most commentators think that's chapter 7, just preceding. I saw in the visions, and so it happened. While I was looking, I was in Shushan, in the citadel, which is the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram with 2 horns. And the 2 horns were high. But there obviously was this genetic effect that didn't quite catch, because one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward so that no animal could withstand him. Nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will. And he became great. So we say he switched from Aramaic back to Hebrew. He has a vision. He is awake. He's in Shushan, which is some 200 miles from the capital of Babylon. We're not really sure why. There is a 2-horned ram, but strangely, one of the horns is larger than the other. The ram pushes westward, northern, and southern. It therefore is coming from which direction? The east. The ram conquers everything in its path. The ram goes on and on, floating. That's the goat. The ram goes on and on, and on to the Super Bowl. Oh, wait, sorry. That was an homage to my good friend, Herb Vieira. But there's a but here in all of this with this ram. In verse 5, it says, and as I was considering the ram and where the ram was going, suddenly a male goat came from the west, across from the surface of the whole earth, without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between the eyes. So you can see these animals, and they have notable horns. Now you know, and I know, because you've read the chapter in the past, you know what some of this is representing. So the ram pushes westward, north, and south. Therefore, it comes from the goat comes from the east, from the west. And there's going to be a collision. He is so fast. And Daniel uses this imagery of this ram and this goat, but he says of the goat, he was so fast, it seems like he's floating. He's moving over the ground so quickly because he is trying to attempt to create a picture in your head. He wants this image in your head of the goat and the ram. So as he tells this vision, it too conquers everything, and it destroys both horns of the ram. It says, then came to the ram that had the two horns which I had seen standing beside, verse 6, and I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. This is significant. This goat and this ram, they collide, and the goat absolutely destroys the ram. So it's goat one, ram zero. So get the image, one comes from the west, one comes from the east, and as it were, they're moving very quickly, and they collide together, and the goat is victorious. Verse 8, therefore the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken. This is on the goat. And in the place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven, and out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Verse 10, and it grew up into the host of heaven, and it cast down some to the host and some of the stars to the ground, and trampled them. He even, verse 11, exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgressions, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this, and he prospered. Again, there is a lot to unpack here. Verse 8 says that there is a large horn. It grows great. It grows powerful. As we will see, this is the king or the leader, and it is Alexander the Great. Alexander is judged as one of the greatest conquerors of all time, next to Genghis Khan. Other than Genghis Khan, he conquered more land in a shorter time and was extremely young. He was in his 20s, and he died in his early 30s. In the battles of Granicus, Issus, and Arbela, Alexander the Great, he defeated larger forces, and he did so in just a few short years. Alexander also, no humble man, named dozens and dozens of cities after himself. They exist today, many of them. In fact, he named one city after his horse. And as we know, and I think some of you may have been to those cities that are named after Alexander. But in verse 8, it says, in verse 8, second part, it was broken, this large horn. It's broken, denoting death. And indeed, Alexander the Great died young, his early 30s, and he died quickly from a mysterious illness. He died allegedly, strangely enough, in Nebuchadnezzar's palace in Babylon. At least that's the legend. So all of this Greece and Babylon and Medo-Persia is all concentrated in this specific area that we know so well. It says there were four horns toward the four winds of heaven that came up. And indeed, that's exactly what did happen. After Alexander the Great's death, four important generals divided his empire. It's called the Wars of the Diadochoi, the successors. There's whole books, reams of books written on these battles of these men. One was named Antigonus. Later, he ruled Syria and part of Asia. He was a Seleucid. There was another, Antigonus Monophthalmus, the one-eyed one. You just picture these guys, this imagery that's being cast. These were the men that came up. Cassander over Macedonia, and Ptolemy over Egypt, Lysimachus over Thrace. So Antigonus, Cassander, Ptolemy, who I'm sure you've heard before, and Lysimachus were the four generals, the four horns that came up after Daniel died. The issue was they were no Alexander, so not in his strength. Verse 9 tells us out of one of them came this little horn. Out of those four horns indeed came the king Antiochus. His full name was Antiochus Epiphanius, which translates loosely, the glorious one or God manifest. Again, another humble servant. He was a Seleucid king. And this is some 400 years approximately after Daniel's vision. Antiochus destroys everything in front of him. Glorious land, Palestine, Israel, Jerusalem, the temple. 11 and 12, let's read it again. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifice. And he cast truth to the ground. He did all this, and he prospered. Antiochus Epiphanes really checks all the boxes here. And indeed, all of this happened. And we know this because we can read it. The daily sacrifices are mentioned two times. They are taken away. In other words, they are literally opposed. The daily sacrifices that were being conducted at the temple, they were taken away. They were done away. Indeed, the horn of the third empire does this, the Grecian Empire. And this section is critical. So for approximately 3 years, the temple is desecrated. Verse 10 has a reference to the starry host. This term refers to, as we'll see later in the later book, chapter 12, it refers to God's people. He opposes the people at the temple precinct that are conducting the sacrifices, the priests and all the attendants, the structure of the temple complex. Let's read verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgressions of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? How long will it last? Now keep in mind, this is Daniel seeing this. He's observing all this. And we'll see what his reaction is. So we see two holy ones, two heavenly beings. He says in verse 14, and he, one of the beings, said to me, Daniel, for 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. Will be cleansed. 2,300, technically the word days is a very poor translation many of you will have in the Bible that you have or in a side margin. It literally means mornings, evenings and mornings of desolation. Then the sanctuary will be cleansed. Because it is a poor translation, and it should be evening and mornings, because it refers to the sacrifices. There were morning sacrifices, and there were evening sacrifices. The words, those of you that have been to Israel, or maybe even West LA, know these terms of Erev and Boker. In the morning, you will say Boker Tov, meaning good morning. I believe it or not, I used it a week or so ago in a Jewish delicatessen. It's also the Erev Boker, good evening. These are very simple terms. So Erev and Boker, meaning evening and morning, is important. Verse 14 says, and until this happens, then the 2300 is over, then will be restored or made cleansed and made righteous, they'll be restored. That word is interesting, and not to give you the Hebrew behind it, it is interesting. It is, when it's cleansed, it is made righteous, it's made whole, it's made upright. The word is tzaddik. You know that word tzaddik from the priest Zadok, which means righteous. Or the other word that you're very familiar with, it's been anglicized, the Sadducees. We know them as the Sadducees. And so this word means righteous, upright, the restored ones. And that's exactly what happens to the temple after these 2,300 evenings and mornings. They are made clean. Note that the word daily sacrifices are mentioned now three times in three verses. They stop. The sacrifices stop. The temple is desolated for a period without those sacrifices. And once again, so we're very clear, it is then restored back to its original function. So there you have it. Daniel 8. Pretty clear, huh? No, it's not clear, as we shall see. It's not clear at all. And it's not clear to Daniel. Daniel, as we will read in the next few verses, doesn't understand. In fact, he calls upon very heavy assistance. And here is one of the most exacting prophecies. But again, and not to get too technical here, and I do apologize, it's probably one of the reasons I looked at Daniel 8 and said, oi, there's a lot here in these very few verses. But we have one of the most exacting of prophecies in Daniel 8. Recall Daniel 2 in the image of four metals, or the composites. And only one is named, the head of gold, which we know was Babylon. Here we will see two more in the following verses named. Their names are going to be mentioned. Let's see if that helps Daniel. We'll also see a heavenly being for the very first time in the Bible being named. That's important. You'll know that name. This chapter recalls chapter 2, the four metals. It also parallels chapter 7 of the four beasts. Four metals, four beasts. Very simple. Now, so let's look back on these verses. We'll be picking it up in verse 15, and we're going to read through with some comment. Then it happened, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, he did not understand, not completely, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai. You remember that's where he was standing, who called and said, Gabriel, first time we've heard that term, that name, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood. And when I came, I was afraid. I fell on my face. He said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. This is interesting. He's afraid. He stands, he falls on his face. He says, now as he was speaking with me, I was in now a deep sleep and my face to the ground. But he touched me, stood me upright. That's significant. He was afraid. He was standing. He falls on his face. He's told to rise, to get up. This is an interesting inference here, and we see it in the book, the books of the New Testament. I'm going to ask you for further study later if you would like to look this up. Acts chapter 10, verse 26, Revelation 19, 10, and Revelation 22, 9 and 10. Acts 10, 26, Revelation 19, 10, Revelation 22, 9 and 10. And there you will find that only before God does a person kneel or be prostrate, never before angels and never before man. It's very significant. And here we have a heavenly being, a type of angel, and he says to get up. Get up so that you'll understand. So let's keep reading. In verse 19, and he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. So specific of the latter time of this indignation he's referring to. For at the appointed time of the end shall be the ram. Notice this, the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be the ram which you saw having two horns. They are the kings of Media and Persia. So he's telling Daniel who they are. And Daniel was very familiar. It was a couple of nation states that were current at the time. And the male goat is the king or kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king that we know historically as Alexander. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, out of that being, that goat, that entity. Four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. So Gabriel has interpreted a little bit further. Greece and Medo-Persia are named. The goat and the ram are named, and no others are named. It shifts to Greece. The first horn is the first king. The four horns are the subsequent kings. Also, we know these things. We know it was Alexander the Great. He did this thing, and he knocked off the Medo-Persia Empire. We know this historically. We also know the four kings that have arisen. And also, that little horn. We also know who that is, who arises out of the four. Again, Antiochus Epiphanes checks all the boxes. He is a king of Syrian descent of the dynasty. He is out of the Grecian Empire. Verse 25, we'll get there in a second. Sorry, skipping ahead. I'm trying to float like a goat. I'm getting too far ahead. But this issue is so critically important. The issue is the little horn of Daniel 8 that we're going to read. In these next few verses, I want you to differentiate it from what we've heard in Daniel 7. So let's read verses 23 through 26. In the latter time of their kingdom, whose kingdom? The antecedent is the four kingdoms that shall arise. In the latter time of these last four kingdoms, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, this king shall arise, Antiochus, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. In other words, something is controlling him. He shall destroy fearfully. and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, literally under his hand. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise up or become like unto against the prince of princes. But he shall be broken without human hands. So not physically. In the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which I told you is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days. The word in the future is added. So this is for the future. There's a lot there. Daniel has been given more information. And again, Daniel 8's little horn that we read here is the third beast or goat, the third metal. It is not the same as Daniel 7's little horn that you heard. That is from iron and clay of the fourth beast, the fourth terrible animal, and we know it as Rome. For 1150 days, Antiochus wreaked havoc on Jerusalem, stopping the sacrifice. He allegedly set up a bronze statue of Zeus in the temple precinct, the father of the Greek gods. The 2300 days, or 1150 evenings and mornings, tied to the sacrifices, he is the little horn. Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, writes this, and I'm going to read it slow for the translation. So on the 5th and 20th day of the month of Kislev, also today known as Kislev, which the Macedonians call Apelles, they lighted the lamps that were on the candlestick and offered incense upon the altar. Now it so fell out that these things were done on the very day on which their divine worship had stopped and was reduced to a profane and common use. After 3 years, the temple was made desolate by Antiochus, and so continued for 3 years. I want you to think of this from Daniel's perspective. Think of what he is watching. Think of what he is, in his mind's eye, imagining. What was Daniel's hope? What did he pray for? Where do we think from previous chapters he prayed, sometimes three times a day? He prayed for Jerusalem. He prayed toward Jerusalem. He wanted to be back from Babylon as a captive. He wanted to worship again in Jerusalem. He wanted the temple restored. He wanted the people to come back. The sacrifices reinstituted. That's what he wanted. And what is he seeing in this vision? He's seeing one nation after another battling it out, only to have one little horn take the temple down, destroy the sacrifices. It's got to be disheartening, horribly disheartening from his perspective, depressing and confusing. But the good news is in 164 BC, Judas Maccabeus led a Jewish revolt in the retaking of Jerusalem. He led the Maccabean revolt against the Seleucids and Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jewish festival of Hanukkah, or dedication, the 25th of Kislev, commemorates this restoration. The festival of lights is also known as the relighting of the temple. Hanukkah, you've all heard of Hanukkah, is not mentioned in the Torah, in the Old Testament. Nowhere is it mentioned, but it is in the Gospels. So I'll give you another little bit of study to do. Where is Hanukkah mentioned in the New Testament specifically? This last point on the 2300 evenings and mornings, not days. Some churches have converted this 2300 mornings and evenings of the 1150 days of sacrifices to years. As I said at the outset, very large Sabbath keeping organization, very large, believed that the 2300 years ended on October 22nd, 1844, for Christ's return. It obviously didn't happen. They were very disappointed. So they modified the interpretation of Christ's return and the cleansing of the sanctuary on earth. The sanctuary to be cleansed was now displaced to heaven. Respectfully, we do not agree. I'll quote from the UCG Daniel 8 commentary on this issue of 2300 evenings and mornings, or 1150 days, or 2300 years. That places it far into the future. The commentary, the United Church of God commentary, states, indeed, some have postulated a 2300-year fulfillment, stretching from ancient times to the future, based on the prophetic day-for-a-year principle, although it is not clear how this could fit. Parenthetically, they add, and this appears unlikely, this interpretation of 2300 years far into the future. This appears unlikely with the particular expression evening and morning, erev boker, which if denoting a day would seem to specific to a 24-hour day, not to a year. However, it goes on to say, and we know this well, in the footsteps of Antiochus, the temple sacrifice would be stopped again in the future. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 24. This verse is very, very popular, very famous with all of us. Matthew 24 and verse 15. I'm only going to read this one section. This is Jesus speaking. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, when you see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then he adds, the writer adds, Matthew adds, this is not in, if you have a red letter edition, this is in black, not the words of Jesus. Notice Daniel, he then says, parenthetically, whosoever reads, let him understand. And that's very, very important. We should always read. We should always try and understand. He is speaking to the disciples about a prophecy. So again, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, understand what you read. These men would see this occur. Prophecy can have and does have repeated fulfillments, all building to an ultimate. It's called type and antitype. It can happen repeatedly and finalized in an ultimate desolation. So he's speaking here to the disciples. Less than 40 years after Christ's words in 66 AD, the Jews rebelled against Rome, or they tried to. It did not go well. Vespasian marched on Jerusalem and succeeded by Titus when he was called back to Rome. Titus, with three legions, squeezed the very life out of Jerusalem, breached the wall, destroyed the temple, and many of you have seen it. And it has never, ever been rebuilt. But further fulfillment could happen again. It could happen. If the temple is rebuilt and sacrifices resumed, it could happen again, a third time. It seems that just about feast time, and we're coming close upon it, we have trumpets, then atonement, then the Feast of Tabernacles. This time of year, it seems, we hear of a group. They are assembling. They're planning. They're getting all the accoutrement, all the necessary details for a rebuilding of the temple. They're assembling to rebuild the temple. When, we do not know. They do not know. It's happened for, I don't know, in my lifetime, for decades, this attempt to rebuild the temple. There's a lot to happen. First of all, don't laugh. Someone sent me an article and he said, do you know what the building permits are going to be needed? By the way, they got to find out what the exact location is. They don't even agree on the location. And there's this other problem of the Muslim presence. So this is no easy rebuilding of the temple. It's complex. But if and when it's rebuilt, if and when it's rebuilt at the very, very end, and sacrifices are stopped, Christ will return. As we heard in the special music, very lovely, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, for the last time, an Antichrist will be defeated. Read if you would, if you go back to Daniel 8, let's read verse 26 again. He says, in the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days hence, or many days in the future. Seal it up. Many people believe this is why Daniel went back to writing from Aramaic, which some Chaldeans read, but not Hebrew. He went back to writing the book in Hebrew. It was to be sealed, hidden for many days. But Daniel, living in Babylon, working with the kings, as even Mr. Randy McKeegan said it, working with the king. He worked for the king. He was an interpreter of dreams. He was the go-to guy. He was the dream expert, and yet, he didn't know in detail, because we've got one more verse to go. Down to the last horn, did he know those details? He did not. He did not have the background of the history that you and I have. Let's read verse 27. And I, Daniel, fainted, was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. No one understood it, even then. Verse 27 says he was fainted, he was sick, he was astonished. The ESV, the English Standard Version, says it this way. And I, Daniel, was overcomingly sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business. But I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. That word appalled is interesting. In the original Hebrew, it's translated 30 times in the New American Standard as the word, strangely enough, desolated. Daniel was desolated by the vision. Desolated, ironically, by the desolation of the abomination of desolation. Daniel was unable to completely and utterly understand. Often, brethren, we see in hindsight. We literally see things 2020 in reverse. This is the year 2020. Hindsight tells us, after we've seen all the details, after something has happened, after it's passed, you will hear people say, "Oh, now it makes perfect sense. I understand it completely now. It all fits together. All the pieces came into place. All of it. It's so easy." And then the phrase is, "Why didn't we see it as clearly when it was happening?" It's because we do see with a rearview mirror. We have 20/20 vision, but it's in a rearview mirror. We don't understand it when it occurs. As you heard from Mr. McKeegan, this plague has befuddled us. It's confusing. There's many different voices. They don't all say the same thing. But it's a good instruction. I am sure a year from now, it will become much, much more clear. But Daniel, with an interpretation and explanation twice, the second time by Gabriel, he is still seemingly troubled. Let's ask some questions. Maybe find some answers. Why was he troubled? Was the destruction of this vision, which he tries to paint in word pictures, in black and white in our Bibles, was it so terrible that he couldn't handle it? Indeed, he wanted the temple restored. He wanted to go back to Jerusalem. And he saw horrible, couldn't have been very settling to him. And this to me is fascinating, because it wasn't still clear. Daniel says so. Says right here in the last verse. No one understood it to a complete degree. They had an idea. They had an outline. But no one understood it beyond that. I wonder. I think this is fascinating. I wonder, does it give us a clue in the year 2020 as to prophecy in the end times? Is it a reminder that we will only see the true details, the details, later, after? Is it a reminder that we are, like Daniel, in Babylon? We have an outline. We have some specifics. We have 2,000 years of written history. Daniel didn't have that. Daniel didn't have Alexander the Great's name. He didn't have Antiochus Epiphanes or the four generals' names. We do. We have their lineage, the battles that they fought. We have all that detail and all subsequent detail. Daniel was told it was Persia, that it was Greece. The horns were kings, about the people of the Holy Land, about the little horn, the big horns. But he never knew of these men and their names individually, as we do. We need to watch, and we need to be aware that God will give us maybe even a foretaste. And I really think in many, many ways, this plague is a foretaste. You think this is bad? This is a dry run. This is only a test. And that's what we see with people when they're under pressure. How will they respond? What will they do? But is this sufficient, the information that we have? Do we need to know, down to the toes and fingers, the details of a prophecy? We see the prophecies thousands of years after the biblical prophets, theoretically, we can understand more. But does it give us the confidence of detail, or does it give it us the confidence and the hope of one day we will understand in detail and will all make sense? In many ways, it's a matter of trust. I've given you enough. You're going to have to take what I've given you, and that should suffice. Daniel gives us a clue, a number of them, I think, of what we need to be doing while living in Babylon. He was sick, but it says he got up. He rose from his bed. He went about, it says, the king's business. I had to go back to work. King was Belshazzar. He knew the king, and he was a demanding king. Was the king that he's referring to Belshazzar? Was it? Yes, he had a physical job, responsibility to the earthly king. But let's read it in an additional way. Let's take that king and put a capital K on it. And again, as the special music told us, maybe it is the king whose business we are to be about. Are we not, as we live in Babylon, to be personally confident, not to boasting of what we believe? We should be confident in our own salvation, first of all, that God has worked in our lives, indeed will work. We're confident in that. We have hope, we have trust, and we have faith in what God will be doing in our lives, our families' lives, those around us and in the world. God is in charge. We also take great comfort in the knowledge he has given us. It is sufficient. It's hard to even grasp what he has given us. And although we have more historical data and support than Daniel, we need to admit, we need to be honest, it is incomplete. It's the old phrase, I'd give you more, but I don't think you can handle the truth. And so it is incomplete and insufficient. But like Daniel, we need to do something. So let us get up, let us arise, and go about the King of Kings business.